Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast, the first episode of the new year. It is 2024. Can you believe it? A new year, a fresh start, a chance for your favorite team to make you mad in a different way, or perhaps the same way, all over again. We will see. I can't wait to find out. My name is Dara McDonald, and with me on the podcast this week is my colleague Anthony Franco. How's it going, Anthony?
I'm doing well. Happy New Year, Dara.
Yeah, likewise. Hope everybody had good holidays. The off season has been on the slow side, but we took a week off during the holidays, so we have 2 weeks of stuff to catch up on. So let's get into that. I've seen a lot of people on Twitter saying that the Dodgers are destroying baseball, and I believe everything I say on Twitter, so I believe that that is the case. We've talked a lot on this podcast about the Dodgers because, frankly, they have made us. They signed Shohei Ohtani, and they acquired Tyler Glasnow and extended him. Since our last episode, they also signed Yoshinobu Yamamoto, 12 years, $325 million, plus posting fee, plus, you know, whatever taxes the Dodgers are going to end up paying over the next 12 years. What did you think, Anthony?
It's a lot. It was a surprising number, even in the context of knowing that our, I think we picked 225 to begin the offseason, and in recent weeks it had become clear that that was going to be well low, and that it was going to be closer to 300. I still didn't think that he was going to beat Gerrit Cole's $324 million, which was the record for a starting pitcher. And so to see Yamamoto, I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that he beat Cole by $1 million and they stretched the contract length to get there. But to see Yamamoto set the record for a pitching contract when he's never thrown a major league pitch is, it's bold, but I mean, I get it, but it's a lot.
Yeah, it's bold. It's by all accounts, he's great. I mean, everybody who's seen him pitch says he's great. All the numbers are great, but he's never faced, a major league lineup. So we'll see. It's a big gamble, but the Dodgers are playing out all the stops this offseason, it seems. They've got their, let's see, I got it up here, competitive balance tax number up to $283 million. So not being shy. So let's look at this rotation now. Ohtani's not going to pitch in 2024. So the rotation is Yamamoto, Glasnow, Walker Buehler, who is coming off of an entirely missed season. Then you got younger guys. Bobby Miller is almost certainly the fourth right now. Then maybe for the fifth, you got guys like Emmett Sheehan, maybe Ryan Yarbrough's in there, maybe a Michael Grove or a Gavin Stone and a couple other prospects. Do you think they're done adding to this rotation now?
I think they could probably use just kind of a lower ceiling sort of innings type, something cheap to take the last spot, just because, I mean, Glasnow said injury stuff. Buehler's coming back from a second Tommy John surgery. And Yamamoto and Bobby Miller, for as talented as they are, have never pitched a full season at the major league level. Miller was good last year, but he was a midseason promotion as a rookie. And obviously Yamamoto has been in Japan the whole time. So I do think that I would feel a little bit better about it if they brought in just somebody who I would feel confident in giving you 130 plus innings to the mix. But ultimately, I think they're done with marquee additions at this point, right?
I would think so. I mean, it's hard to discount anything at this point. They've been aggressive, but they've also never, like, I know that they're doing a lot of stuff in the rotation this winter, but it's also never been their thing to, you know, just give out a huge deal to a free agent pitcher. Ohtani is obviously a special case. Glasnow wasn't a free agent. It was just an extension. Yamamoto is another special case because he's so young. But they don't usually go out and sign the, you know, Blake Snell, Jordan Montgomery types. So it would be a surprise if they did something like that. Even though I picked Snell to go to the Dodgers earlier in the season, but that was before they did all this other stuff. Yeah, so I would expect a smaller move of some kind, just because, I mean, as much as they've done it's weird. They've done so many headline grabbing things, but they're still looking at, you know, they have question marks at the back of the rotation still somehow.
Yeah. And we didn't mention Clayton Kershaw, but I imagine that they'll try to bring him back as well. I would be very surprised if he's not a Dodger next year in some fashion, but obviously he wouldn't address the kind of bulk innings concern early in the season.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm more in the, I think that there's a door open there for him to become a Ranger, but that's probably a conversation for another day. But yeah, Kershaw could definitely be in the mix, but not until the second half because his shoulder surgery is keeping him out. I mean, it's not clear, but probably till, I think he's just said mid-season or something like that when he announced the surgery. So June, July, something like that. But the Yamamoto sweepstakes, there were lots of other clubs in there. The New York clubs and the Giants and the Phillies and the Red Sox and the Blue Jays. What do you think the fallout of this is, of the Dodgers winning this?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be different for different teams, right? It seems like the Mets and to maybe a lesser extent, the Phillies kind of viewed him as an exceptional case. And he was like a priority target for the Mets. And if they didn't get Yamamoto, they were just going to not punt on the offseason or anything like that. But he was going to be their big splash. And all reports are that they don't have any interest in pivoting to a Snell or a Montgomery. Now, the Yankees, maybe the Red Sox, I could see kind of rounding down, but staying at the top of the pitching market in some fashion with one of those two guys. We'll talk, I'm sure, about the Red Sox, Giolito, and Sale moves later on. But it feels like those teams kind of went into the offseason looking for rotation help, and Yamamoto happened to be the best one available, whereas some of the other teams were treating him as a special case because he's so young and so talented.
Yeah, it seems like at some point the dam on this offseason has to break, because it felt like for a long time it was going pretty slow. I think you mentioned in your post on New Year's that only 22 out of our top 50 free agents have signed thus far. So that means there's still 28 out there. And it seemed like Ohtani and Yamamoto were occupying a lot of the oxygen in the room for a while. And then they came off the board, and then it was the holidays. So now we're recording this on January 2nd. The holidays are over. There's still so many free agents that have to be signed, you know, trades that have to be consummated. And we're only 6 weeks from spring training right now, if you can believe it. So maybe the next 6 weeks will be very, very active with those other teams pivoting to other targets. Now, you mentioned what the Red Sox have pivoted to. A very interesting couple of moves here. So they agreed to terms with Lucas Giolito. As you said, it's a 2-year deal, but he can opt out after the first, which was widely expected to be what he would get. And then the next day, they traded Chris Sale, a kind of out of nowhere deal that I don't think anybody saw coming, to Atlanta for Vaughn Grissom. So what was your take on this whole sequence of things for Boston, Anthony?
I like both moves for the Red Sox. I thought Giolito was fine. That was, like you mentioned, just sort of what we expected he would do. 2 years. That's kind of the new pillow contract for, at least for priority reclamation targets. Not everybody's going to be able to command that. But if you're kind of one of the top options in terms of like bounce back candidates, you typically now get 2 years with an opt out as opposed to a straight 1 year deal. So that one seemed okay to me. I thought the Chris Sale Vaughn Grissom trade was a very good move for them. That's a no brainer for me from their perspective. You know, I know that they had to pay down a good portion of Sale's $27.5 million salary. I think they chipped in 17.5, but still, you got 6 years of club control over what I think is going to be at least an average, maybe slightly above average, everyday second baseman who can step in, fills a role in the roster right away. And we'll talk about the Atlanta angle of it, I'm sure. But to me, like I thought that was one of the better trade acquisitions of the offseason so far. But am I higher than you on Grissom, or are you also optimistic there?
No, I think it has a high chance to work out very well for the Red Sox. I mean, especially because I know there are a lot of Red Sox fans who want them to go for it. And especially because what's his name said full throttle owner guy.
I think it was Tom Warner. One of them.
One of the guys that's not Craig Breslow. I can't remember right now. But yeah, so a lot of Red Sox fans have been upset that it's not been full throttle. And so this is sort of like a move that, I mean, there's a chance it doesn't work out for them in 2024, but the long run, the chances of the of them sort of coming out ahead on it are pretty good. You know, Sale has only one guaranteed year left on his deal. He does have the option for 2025, but, you know, he's been hurt a lot, so it's not even a guarantee that he pitches well enough for that to get picked up. So, you know, it's an everyday regular on the cheap, perhaps. I mean, we can't just guarantee that Grissom's going to get in there, but the main thing with Grissom, like, he's always hit. The main thing was, like, where is he going to play? And he didn't have a place to play in Atlanta, and now he has a place to play in Boston. So there's little reason to, you know, doubt him at this point. So I think it's great for them. But
on just the way that the team looks right now, I mean, they've been tied to Montgomery and Shota Imanaga, Teoscar Hernandez. Do you think that they're, I'm probably a little higher on them than consensus, but do you think that they're in position where if they land one of those very good but not elite free agents at this point, do you think that they are a playoff caliber team?
I mean, I would lean against them in the short term just because the division is so strong. There's like, you know, who would the Red Sox finish ahead of? You know what I mean? Like, it's so tough. Like, the Yankees obviously had a kind of a down year in 2023, but they went out, got Juan Soto. Presumably they're going to get something for their rotation after missing out on Yamamoto. So they're going to be strong. The Orioles are just loaded with so much talent. The Rays gave up Glasnow, but they always seem to do this, you know, where they trade guys away and find guys who are just as good on the cheap. The Jays still have, you know, really strong pitching staff, and they're probably not done upgrading the lineup or doing whatever they're doing. So I don't know. Even if the Red Sox like look decent on paper, they still have to beat at least one team to get a wild card spot. And then that's not even accounting for the fact that the West is strong as well. So, you know, the Rangers, Astros, Mariners are all going to be in that wild card mix. So I don't know. Them seeing them as a playoff club, I would hesitate, but I mean, it does seem like a lot of stuff is moving in the right direction overall.
Yeah, I think maybe I'm a little lower on the division outlook than you, but we can discuss that. That'll be a spring training topic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of stuff to happen between now and then, but yeah, I mean, yeah, if Grissom just steps in and is an everyday second baseman, then that's huge for them. But also, I mean, you mentioned the Atlanta perspective. I also don't hate this from the Atlanta perspective. I think this is a kind of trade where I like it from both clubs' perspective, because for Atlanta, you know, when Chris Sale was on Boston and he was kind of their ace, that's when you look at that roster, you're kind of like, that's not a great position to be in because he's been so shaky of late that if that's your ace. But if he's the number four starter in Atlanta, then suddenly you're like, that's a much nicer way to use Sale, I think. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I get it. I have a front office post that'll go out before people hear this. So if you're a front office subscriber, you can see my full thoughts on it. I understand it from Atlanta's perspective. I think it's risky, but they're in a situation where, and this is sort of true of the Dodgers as well, a little bit, but the lineup is so good that it feels like they can not assume that they're going to make the playoffs, but they can feel pretty good about their chances to get to the playoffs, even if the rotation has some injury questions or things like that, bumps in the road along the way. And so you're sort of in a position where, as a front office, you can swing for upside and target guys who feel like they can really make a difference once you get to October. And Sale has that potential in a way that wouldn't necessarily be the case if they had just played it safe and signed a mid-level free agent like a Michael Walker or somebody like that.
Yeah, and it seems like it's sort of this similar logic with the lineup that you mentioned, that, you know, 1 through 8, it's so strong that they can take a chance on a guy like Kelnick who has these strikeout concerns. But, you know, maybe if Kelnick is striking out at 30% of the time still, if he's hitting, you know, 18 to 20 home runs out of the number 9 spot in the lineup, that's a great position to be in when the rest of the team is so strong.
Yeah, what I do think is interesting, and we'll never know the answer to this, is they took on a lot of money early in the offseason in their kind of series of not necessarily depth additions, but additions towards the back half of the roster with Kelnick and Aaron Bummer. And they took on some of the Matt Carpenter salary to add Ray Kerr to the bullpen. And they moved some stuff around to get David Fletcher as like a utility guy. And I do wonder if they hadn't taken on so much money early in the offseason on those depth pieces, if maybe they wouldn't have had to ask Boston to include so much money on the Sale contract, and if there was some way that they could have gotten Sale without giving up Grissom if they hadn't made all the kind of somewhat head-scratching decisions that they made early in the offseason. But ultimately, it's still a really good roster. And while this probably wasn't the way that I would have gone about the offseason, to me, they're still clearly the best team in the NL East.
Yeah, their competitive balance tax figure right now, at least according to Roster Resource, is just under $276 million. So they're right up against the third line, which is $277 million. So if, I mean, we don't know. I mean, if this is the limit of their spending, then yeah, you're right. It's interesting because they took on a lot of money to move those pieces around. And so was that the best use? I don't know. Time will tell. And like you said, maybe we'll never know. But it will be an interesting thing to debate, especially if Kelnick thrives or if Kelnick does not thrive. Okay, so what else we got here? One thing, let's talk about the Royals, because I think Tim and I wanted to talk about the Royals in the last episode, but we ended up getting squeezed out because other stuff was going on. The Royals have been active and have given out a number of deals to a number of guys, but I think overall you were kind of underwhelmed, Anthony, which is another thing you wrote about for front office subscribers. So let me just quickly, before you get into it, we do this on every show. We beg you to sign up for the front office package because we want your money and also because we think it's a good deal. You get rid of the ads for less than $3 a month, and you get extra articles from Anthony and Steve every week into your email. And the contract tracker is awesome and so on and so forth. It's a great deal. But anyway, you had an article about the Royals and how you were kind of underwhelmed. Is that fair to say, by what they've done, even though it's been kind of like a nice volume thing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any issue with any individual move. You know, maybe I wouldn't have given Hunter Renfro $13 million in an opt-out clause or something like that. But ultimately, that's a very small quibble. In isolation, I thought all their moves were fine. They have a long way to go, right? I mean, they're coming up from a 56-win team, and it seems like they've tried to raise the roster floor more than the ceiling. So they're going for middle innings or setup types and mid rotation guys and just trying to add some sort of stability, which is fine. But I still think, one, a lot of it has been on the pitching side. And so the lineup is still not good. Like, it's a bottom five lineup for me. And it's a sort of, a lot of these have felt like finishing touches type moves for a contender in a way that the Royals just aren't there yet. And so, again, I don't know about underwhelming, because they should want to get better coming off a 56-win season, and they are better, clearly. But it's just, if I weren't in that position, I think I would have swung a little more for upside plays, maybe taken more of like a Tigers-like approach, where they took bounce-back shots on Jack Flaherty and brought in Kenta Maeda and something like that, as opposed to prioritizing kind of stable but lower ceiling players.
So looking at this division, I mean, we talked about how some of the divisions are really strong, but I think most people would agree that the AL Central is the weakest in baseball. I think it's probably not even that close. But you mentioned they're coming from way down, losing over 100 games. So let's quickly recap in case anybody doesn't know. They added Michael Wacha and Seth Lugo to the rotation, so two stable veterans there. Hunter Renfro to the lineup. And then the bullpen, they added a few vets like Will Smith, Nick Anderson, Chris Stratton, guys like that. So spreading the money around to a few sort of solid, decent-ish guys. When you add a couple of decent-ish guys to a 100-loss team, how much better does it make it? Where do you think they are now?
I would take them over the White Sox in that division, but they're clearly number four for me. Like, I don't. Minnesota and Detroit are the top two. Cleveland would be a clear three, and then I would have Kansas City fourth.
All right. Well, do you think there's any is there any advantage for there's a lot of young players on the Kansas City team. Is there any advantage in like a player's development in playing for a 70 win team instead of playing for like a 55 win team.
Sure. Like, I mean, again, you don't want to be a disaster. So I understand that part of it. I don't even have an issue with them adding players necessarily. It's just like, if I would have felt better about it if they had signed one of Lugo or Waka and brought in one of the mid-tier hitters, like a Lourdes Gurriel or a Jamer Candelario, just something to kind of raise the floor of the offense, because I think they're going to have still a lot of trouble scoring runs this year.
All right. Well, speaking of underwhelming, let's talk about the Blue Jays, because they've been connected to all the big names so far this offseason, you know, from Shohei Ohtani on down. But so far, they added a couple glove first guys in Kevin Kiermaier and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. Did you have any thoughts on these, Anthony?
They're okay. I don't. I'll mostly defer to you on the Jays, because I assume people know this, but you're a Toronto guy and at least like nominally a Jays fan. So how do you feel about what they've done and where do you expect them to go from here?
I am very confused by both of these moves, to be perfectly honest with you. Okay. And it's, you know, it's my job to understand these things and explain them to our readers. So that's not good. The Kiermaier thing is fine in a sense. I mean, he was on the team last year and was fine, but I just thought it really seemed to me in 2023 that they signed Kiermaier because they signed Kiermaier before they got Varsho. And it seemed like maybe they were talking catcher trades, you know, because everybody knew they were going to trade a catcher. And they were probably talking about a bunch of different deals and didn't really know that they were going to get Varsho. And then once they had Varsho and Kiermaier, it was kind of not perfect because they're both glove first left-handed outfielders who are excellent defenders. And so all season long, I was assuming that once Kiermaier's deal was done, they would move Varsho over to center and then get like a bat first corner outfielder. And so for them to run it back with Kiermaier again and like double down on this defense first thing was surprising to me. The Kiner-Falefa deal, I have no clue what's going on with that one. because I don't know what Kiner-Falefa really adds to the team. Like, obviously he's a strong defender, but he's never been a good hitter. Like, he's basically always been kind of, I think, like weighted runs created plus around 80. And it's not, he doesn't even have like a good platoon split or anything. So it's not like, you know, his right-handed bat can pair with, you know, he's played some outfield. So it's like, oh, you know, could his right-handed bat pair with Kiermaier and Varsho and they have this like super defense outfield thing, but he's not even a good platoon guy. If they wanted a platoon right-hitting outfielder, they could have got Michael A. Taylor or Harrison Bader. There's other guys out there they could have done that with. If they think of him as like a utility infielder who can just like move around, they have other guys that can do that as well. Like, I mean, they have Biggio, they have Espinal, they have all these sort of guys in the minors who seem like they could probably do just as well as IKF. You know, like they got Ernie Clement and Leo Jimenez and all these guys. I guess they're like, they liked the versatility of Merrifield, that he could do both, and they will probably do something like that with IKF, but he doesn't hit. So I don't know. Am I way off base here, or is this like a real head scratcher?
No, yeah, I didn't really get that one. I like the Kiermaier one maybe a little more than you did, but the IKF one, I agree. It feels like there were just a bunch of guys on the team who already did what he does. How much better would you feel? It doesn't seem like they're done, right? I mean, I think they're going to add some sort of middle of the order bat, maybe a DH. Would you feel okay with the offseason if they came away with a JD Martinez or a Rhys Hoskins type? Or would it still, I mean, even obviously once they didn't get Ohtani, everything kind of feels underwhelming at that point. But I think going into the winter, you probably didn't expect them to be super involved in Ohtani. So if they came away with a JD Martinez, Kiermaier reunion and Kiner-Falefa, would that be an okay offseason in your view?
They would probably still have to re-sign Chapman or something. Like, looking at them relative to the 2023 club, they lost Chapman, Belt, Kiermaier, and Merrifield. So they brought back Kiermaier, so that's a wash. let's say they view IKF as like a better defending but lesser hitting version of Merrifield, and you call that a draw. And then, like you said, they sign like JD Martinez or Rhys Hoskins or somebody to be Brandon Belt. You still have a hole at third base. And I mean, they theoretically have some prospects who could step in there, but then, you know, you're going from a, I mean, we've debated Matt Chapman on this podcast, but I think it's fair to say that even the people who are low on him, you know, admit that he's a solid 3 to 5 win guy just based on his glove and power. And, you know, it would be a risk to expect one of the prospects to step in there. So, I mean, if it at this point, if it's Chapman and a bat, then it's kind of a wash. But, you know, obviously after a kind of like semi-underwhelming season, you'd want better than a wash.
Yeah. Thanks, Sam.
But yeah, I guess I would also say, I mean, I don't know. I think that the possibility of a trade is still there. I mean, anytime a team has kind of like a semi-redundancy, but I don't know. Is there any other team out there that's like champing at the bit to get their hands on Santiago Espinal or whatever? So I don't know what their like seeming surplus of depth pieces is going to turn into, but we'll see. Like you mentioned, they're not done. Okay, still more stuff to catch up on. Well, how about this? This is interesting. The Mariners, we've talked before. I think we mentioned it on the podcast, but it's definitely been mentioned elsewhere on MLB trade rumors, perhaps in some front office pieces. But Jerry DePoto, since being hired by the Mariners, had never given a multi-year deal to a hitter in, I don't know, what was it, like 7, 8, 9 years? How long has he been there? But whatever it is, he finally did it, and Mitch Garver got 2 years. How do you like Mitch Garver in Seattle, Anthony?
I like it quite a bit. I thought he should get 3 years as the best catcher available. The fact they got him at 2 for 24, I'm on board. He's really good. I know he gets hurt a lot, but he can really hit, and the Mariners needed that badly. I don't really understand why Texas wouldn't have matched 224, but I like it for Seattle.
I guess Texas has concerns about their cable money. It seems like because they don't have, they don't know what their TV money situation is. It seems like they're kind of just hovering under the luxury tax until they get more information on that. But yeah, Mitch Garver, he can hit, and he fits greatly on that club because his best fit is on a team that already has a catcher that they like, because, you know, you can use Garver, I don't know, let's say 30, 40 games behind the plate if he's healthy, and then in the DH spot the rest. And the Mariners have Cal Raleigh, who's great. So it's a nice 1-2 punch, one of them behind the plate, one of them DHing most of the time, I assume. So it's nice for them. They needed that punch. Do you think we're going to get a bit more? Like, they still need some outfield help, right?
Yeah, I mean, DePoto has talked about wanting at least one outfielder. Right now, I think it's, at least on roster resource, the projected corner outfield is Cade Marlowe and Dominic Canzone. You can't have both those guys projected for regular roles. Taylor Trammell's in there, Dylan Moore, but it's a lot of mix and match type players. And so I would expect probably another multi-year deal. Somebody to at least raise the floor of the outfield a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So that's exciting for the Mariners fans. You never got to enjoy a nice multi-year deal for a hitter before, and now maybe you'll get two. Okay. So what else is going on? Still lots of other stuff to catch up on. Frankie Montas to the Reds. I'm a bit surprised that they've added as much pitching as they did. I know that they needed pitching, but they've been pretty active. How do you like the fit with Frankie Montas there?
I have no idea. I don't know what to make of Montas, because he hasn't pitched in a while. I think he pitched like 2 innings at the end of the season, but he basically missed the whole year with the shoulder injury. I don't know. It's the upside is very high. I understand why they did it. $16 million it's a risk for a Reds team that doesn't typically run huge payrolls. I like the Nick Martinez pickup for them more, I think.
So would you say, because they're a little bit closer to contending, that your take on them is sort of the opposite of the Royals, where, you know, they were making safe picks, whereas they should have been taking risks, whereas the Reds, being as close to contention as they are, should have been opting for more safe guys to just eat some innings and just, you know, keep them in the mix.
That's a good question. I don't know if I would go that far, just because I do think that they're closer to contention than the Royals, obviously, but they are still sort of in that mix as like a young team that you're counting on a lot of young guys to take a step forward. And their rotation has a lot of talent. So I don't have an issue with an upside play necessarily. I just, Montas, I mean, again, he's just very, very volatile coming off an injury, a lost season injury. And I don't know that I would have taken him over a $13 million flyer on Luis Severino or $14 million on Jack Flaherty, but I understand why they did it.
Yeah, because they got, it's an interesting group now. Hunter Green, Andrew Abbott, Nick Lodolo, Graham Ashcraft. There's a lot of arms in there, but I guess the thing is that, like, with those unproven guys, you don't know who's going to step up and be that sort of, like, playoff caliber, like, lights out kind of guy. And Frankie Montas at least gives you, like, an outside chance at that, depending on if his shoulder is in good shape. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for this week. We had a lot to catch up on, so we didn't take questions, but we will probably take questions next week unless, a whole bunch of stuff happens between now and then and we're just too overwhelmed. But anyway, thank you for coming on the show, Anthony.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me back on. It's been a couple of weeks.
Like I said, happy holidays and happy new year to everybody. And we will be following, like I mentioned earlier, I hope a lot of stuff is going to happen in the next 6 weeks between now and spring training. Still lots of free agents out there, still lots of trades that need to happen. So keep it tuned to MLBTR and sign up for the front office package. And we'll be back with another podcast episode next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLB Trade Rumors.